We kick things off with good stuff right out of the box here. Joining us in studio from the Amera Astronomy Center at the University of Maine, Sean Latch is back in to visit with us. Sean, welcome. Good to have you here. And we said it before you came on. Love that shirt you're wearing today.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Yeah, my sister got me a great gift for Christmas, a nice little print that has some galaxies and planets and all kinds of fun stuff on it. So
this is why we need a video stream, so people could see this shirt and find out a way to make that happen. Well, a lot of things going on at the Amera Astronomy Center this month, but first and foremost, coming up in less than 2 weeks, a lunar eclipse.
Yeah, we have the first total lunar eclipse visible here in the state of Maine since 2015. So it is a chance to see it the evening of the 20th and 21st of this month. The eclipse is going to start around 9:36. The moon will enter the penumbral shadow, which is the lighter outer shadow. At 10:33, it'll enter the umbra, and you'll start to notice a pretty serious change at that time. And then from roughly 11:41 to 12:43, you have a little over an hour of totality, with the deepest portion of the eclipse at 12:12 a.m. on the morning of the 21st. The great thing is, of course, the 21st is a holiday, so most folks should be able to sleep in, and so if they do want to stay up late for the eclipse, they should get a great view.
That sounds outstanding, and we'll hope for clear skies. You never know.
Yeah, we are hoping. We're going to be doing a couple things to prepare for it. We have an event. I'll be doing a talk at the Bangor Public Library this week, Saturday, so on the 12th, coming up here at 2 o'clock. I'll be doing a free presentation there about the lunar eclipse and also talking about eclipses in general. And then on the eclipse day, Sunday the 20th, we have a 3:30 showing of Totality, the Wonder of Eclipses, where we take a look at solar and lunar eclipses with a special live update on the upcoming one. And that evening, if the weather cooperates, we'll have the telescope open from 9:15 until as late as people stay, giving folks a chance to look through the telescope at the lunar eclipse.
That's wonderful. Fantastic. Also coming up Friday, your regular program's coming up, Expedition Reef.
Yeah, we had a sellout show for our first one, which was last week Friday. And Expedition Reef takes a look at coral reefs around the world and some of the things that are threatening them, of course. Most folks think of corals as being something that's tropical only, but there are coral reefs off Maine and deep water corals. And in fact, one of the things we do is we have a live introduction that takes a look at coral research here in the state of Maine, at the University of Maine in particular. And actually the 25th of the month, we're going to be having a special book signing. Dr. Malcolm Schick just released a book. He's from UMaine, a professor emeritus, and released a book, Where Corals Are, A Natural History. And that we'll take a look at that as well. So he'll be there for a book signing and a little special presentation that evening as well.
Excellent. And Sunday, Magic Treehouse Space Mission.
Yes, our fun children's program based on the Mary Pope Osborne series. Magic Treehouse, of course, takes students on a little journey through our universe. They're looking for answers to a variety of questions about space and astronomy. And so it's a fun program, and the kids always love that one.
And coming up, I think it's a week from Thursday, the Science Lecture Series, and this time all about solar energy.
Yeah, we have Danny Piper coming in. He is from Sundog Solar, and he's doing a presentation about solar power in Maine and taking a look at some of the policy and changes here in Maine and how Maine is situated for solar power and how that's been changing over time. So it'll be a great chance to learn about the potential of that clean energy here for our state.
We're talking with John Lash of Amera Astronomy Center. So much going on in terms of anniversaries and exploration. I'm completely fascinated by what's going on with New Horizons. Checking in now from the Kuiper Belt. And for anybody who's not a fan of space, can you describe where that is in relation to us?
Yeah, the Kuiper Belt is basically a group of objects out sort of beyond Neptune. And so you have Pluto is out in that area as well. The object that New Horizons passed by on New Year's Eve was called Ultima Thule, and it's about 1 billion miles farther than Pluto. It's the most distant object we've ever encountered. If you just look it up on the website, NASA images will come up right away, but they got some really great shots of it. It's a very tiny object, and their first images looked a little bit like a snowman, or some folks say BB-8 if you're a Star Wars fan, so lots of cool things to... But it is one of the most distant objects, and one of the things they're excited about there is this basically gives us a chance to look at sort of a piece of the solar system from the formation really in a frozen or pristine state. And so that's what's very exciting about it. But yeah, it's the most distant object we ever visited. And going from that being very far to going to the Chinese landing on the far side, not the dark side. I know there's a lot of Pink Floyd fans out there, and I am too, but the far side of the moon, because there is no, quote, dark side. The moon goes through day and night, so doesn't have a permanent dark side. But Chang'e 4 landed on the moon on January 3rd, and the Chinese actually have a relay satellite that's sending back information from that. And that's the first time that humans have landed a payload package on the far side of the moon. All of our other landings were on the near side, the side that faces us.
And, of course, throughout the next several months, we'll be looking back at anniversaries of the moon landing, Apollo 11, 50 years ago this summer, which doesn't seem possible to me.
Yep.
But, just a couple of weeks ago was the anniversary of Apollo 8. And
right.
we had Bob Kersen on the show, who wrote a wonderful book on that flight and pointed out that from the perspective of the NASA people, that Apollo 8 mission was perhaps even more challenging than Apollo 11 and landing on the moon.
Yeah, it was one of those things. I mean, it was the first time we were actually sending a crew to go around and actually orbit the moon. It was the first time you do anything. It can be awful, sort of pins and needles, if you will, in terms of, being sure that you're able to do this. And of course, they also had that radio silence when they went around the far side.
Right.
So they were actually the first humans to really see the far side with their real eyes. So pretty incredible to do it that way.
And what was remarkable is that prior to that Apollo 8 flight, we had only traveled, I wanted to say, no more than 700 or 800 miles from Earth.
Yeah, basically low Earth orbit, and which is where most of our, when we send humans most of the time, that's where they're going, low Earth orbit, whether they go to the International Space Station, when the shuttle used to fly, things like that. So, it was sort of the most distant place we were sending humans to. And the first time you do that, there's, of course, a lot of trepidation. NASA has a really good track record on those things. But, of course, they had, a couple issues with some of the early Apollo stuff, like Apollo 1 had the tragic fire. And so it was one of those things that was a little bit scary for them up front.
Bruce was asking before we came on about a chance to view meteors, but it doesn't look like it's going to be very good.
Well, we had the Quadranted meteor shower at the beginning of the month. Sort of the 3rd through the 5th was the primary peak of that. You might still see a few, but the weather over the next few days is not looking really good, so we'll have to wait. And then, of course, now we're going to start to get more of the moon in the sky as we start to move towards that full moon, for the lunar eclipse coming up here on the 20th and 21st.
And other than looking at the moon, what planets are visible in the either the morning or the evening skies this time of year?
So right now we have Mars in our evening sky. It's almost directly south at sunset, and it'll be visible for a few hours after sunset. Everything else right now is in the morning sky. So Venus and Jupiter, which are respectively the 3rd and 4th brightest thing we see in our sky, other than the sun or moon, are in the morning sky right before sunrise. Mercury really low on the horizon and tough to see, and Saturn is just starting to rejoin that parade, you might say, in the morning, so it will also be sort of low on the horizon. But everything else is kind of in the morning sky at this point.
One of my favorite books, because I love science, but I'm not good at it, but I love Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything, and I go back and reread it, I think, once a year, and I love when he talks about the scale of our planetary system.
Yes.
Because we all grew up with that model with the styrofoam,
mm-hmm.
and everything was contained in a table about the size of what we're working on here.
Right.
But, of course, that's so far from reality, particularly when you get to the outer planets.
Yeah, most folks don't realize that, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars are roughly equally spaced out. But when you go from Mars to Jupiter, you triple the size of the solar system. When you go from Jupiter to Saturn, you double it. From Saturn to Uranus, you double it again. So it really does, give folks a little bit of pause if they really get an idea of the distance between those planets. And then, of course, if you want the distances and the scale, really to be able to see things, you would use what's called a 1,000-yard model, where you have the Earth, which is about the size of the Sun, which is about the size of a basketball. The Earth is the size of a peppercorn, and Jupiter's like a plum. And you'd have this spread out, again, over 1,000 yards. Of space, and that would give you an idea from the Sun out to Pluto of how distant and how spread things are, between. It's like the asteroid belt. In science fiction movies, you see, things flying through the asteroid belt, zigging and zagging and, having to barely make it. And the truth is, we've flown all kinds of things through our asteroid belt, all the Pioneers, Voyagers, anything that's went to Jupiter and Saturn, like Cassini and Galileo, and you know, New Horizons out to, you know, well past that, Pluto and things like that. All those have had to go through. There's literally millions of miles between individual asteroids, even though there's, you know, more than a million asteroids there. Again, they're so spread out that there's lots of space between them. So yeah, sometimes I always tell folks science fiction is fun. I got interested probably because of Star Wars when I was a kid, in addition to liking the night sky. But it is emphasis on the fiction a lot of times.
Yeah. And for somebody who doesn't follow it closely, what's the difference? Can you explain the difference between an asteroid and a comet?
Yeah, so asteroids basically are leftover chunks of primarily rock and metal from the formation of our solar system. The bulk of them are between Jupiter and Mars in the main asteroid belt. There are some what we call near-Earth asteroids, which come very close to the Earth and even intersect our orbit. Comets are basically icy snowballs that typically are out in the outer solar system. When they fall towards the sun, if they get close enough, the sun will melt off some of that material and the solar wind will push off a little bit of a tail, which is formed primarily of gas and dust. And they can look really beautiful in the sky. Now, we haven't had really good ones since Hale-Bopp and Hyakutake. Back in December, we did have this comet that was visible. But it really, I mean, you needed binoculars and it didn't have much of a tail. It was a periodic comet that returns about every 7 years or so.
Now, as we learn more and as we travel further out, what are the chances, first of all, that Pluto might regain its planetary status at some point? And what are the chances that we elevate some other objects to that status that we're not aware of yet or we haven't been able to get a good look at?
Yeah, well, one of the things, Pluto got demoted because of its size and because it, you know, the inclination of its orbit, it hadn't cleared its orbit because we started finding other objects out there. So we found objects that are actually larger than Pluto, like Eris, Haumea, Makemake, Sedna, Quarar, there's a bunch more, but that are all out past Pluto. And, you know, one of the things is, of course, we keep finding objects out there and they're tilted more to a different inclination. So all the rest of the planets are sort of in the same plane. And we think they all formed out of, you know, the same solar nebula and sort of left over and you know, coalesced and formed that way. With these other objects, they also formed out of leftovers, but some of them may be escape moons, some of them may be other things. And so the chances that Pluto will be made a planet again, probably not so likely. I know I was a Pluto fan and, you know, and things like that, but it's a reclassification. I mean, it's still, like I tell folks, it's still part of our solar system. It's now considered a dwarf planet, but it, you know, there are objects which are much larger, out, you know, well beyond Pluto in the solar system. And we keep discovering more. There's been this big hunt for planet, nine now, which, they found a number of these objects that they've discovered, they think may be giving evidence to a larger mass planet, something roughly 9 or 10 Earth masses, which should be way out in the solar system. So we'll have to wait and see if they actually find that, but that is something that they are searching for right now.
And I know because of the variances of its orbit, it sometimes changes position. What's closer to us right now, Pluto or Neptune?
So Neptune is, from 1979 to 1999, there's basically roughly a 20-year period in Pluto's 248 years that it takes to orbit the sun where it was closer to us. And so there again, there's a lot of sort of bits of information that make it look more and more like, more than likely, Pluto was an escape moon or a captured object, if you will, compared to being, you know, just formed as a planet on its own in the solar system.
Love it. Sean Latch from the Amera Astronomy Center. So again, the lunar eclipse coming up on the 20th. If people want to come up and see things there, should they call in advance or can they just show up?
So for the planetarium show, which is going to be 3:30 on the afternoon of the 20th, they should get their tickets in advance if they can, just in case, because occasionally we do sell out. For the viewing, they can just come on up, but I would say check your skies. If you're not seeing stars and it's not clear, please don't come up because there won't be anyone there, because it has to be clear for us to open for the telescope portion of things.
All right. Sounds great, Sean. We thank you as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll see you again next month.